Please don't record or broadcast this talk because this is not, you know, it's not prepared for this.
No,
kind of. So, but anyway, so I was actually asked specifically to talk about some of the ideas which we are developing towards the quantum clock network. So, and what I hope to do today is basically to maybe give you a little bit of a sense how kind of quantum information can someday help to make some kind of very precise measurements of something that perhaps you are interested in. But also maybe kind of in the spirit of this workshop, speculate about what sort of measurements one could do. And that's this last part of this talk, you know, kind of don't, you know, throw tomatoes, don't shoot, you know, this. But I think it's very much in the spirit that was advertised by previous talk, right? So whatever you can measure would be good, right? So anyway, so here is what I'm planning to do. I'm planning to give you a little bit of introduction about quantum metrology and networks, and then I will tell you about sort of our ideas, how one could maybe someday build these networks, quantum networks of clocks. I will describe you the idea and tell you perhaps how that it might be feasible, you know, eventually. Then maybe what I hope also to discuss with many of you is whether this network could be useful for something. And this could be, for example, non-local precision measurements. So in the last part of my talk, that's when, you know, I want to speculate a little bit. And in particular, I want to talk about quantum measurements of fast processes, and that might have some relevance to the discussion yesterday and also to dark energy detection. Okay, so you've heard already several talks about atomic clocks. So this is basically a device which should consist from source, like a laser or microwave, some oscillator, usually atom. So there is usually some kind of controller. So it's basically a way to how this oscillator can interrogate, how the source can interrogate the oscillator. And then, of course, we need to basically have some kind of feedback loop. So for the purpose of today's talk, I would like to focus on this kind of part, on this controller, which, you know, in practice in clocks involves the so-called Ramsey measurement. So, and what this Ramsey measurement is the following. So you basically first prepare atoms in a well-defined state, or sometimes say just, you know, prepare it automatically. And then you basically interrogate them with a sequence of pulses. And so the simplest pulse sequence is so-called Ramsey measurements sequence, where what you do, you basically prepare a coherent superposition of the two clock states and just then let it evolve. And then some time later, time t later, what you do, you apply another pulse of light, the so-called pi over 2 pulse. And this kind of sequence essentially allows you to measure the relative phase between the atom and your source, your laser, for example. And so basically, you know, that's this relative phase, which is proportional to the difference of frequencies multiplied by the evolution time. And basically, if you can measure this phase very, very precisely, you can find this difference very precisely, then you can basically correct the source of your, the phase of your source, such that to lock it precisely to the source of this atomic transition. So that's how the clocks work. And basically, you know, this, you know, phase estimation uncertainty immediately translates into this frequency or time uncertainty, this Allen variance, which has been discussed yesterday. So now let me tell you where does a kind of quantum mechanics or quantum noise enters into this. So, but in order to understand it, let's just, you know, set some language. So the long-term precision of this operation will be based on the following. So basically what you will do, you will do multiple cycles of interrogation followed by feedback. So, so basically in total, for example, you can run the time t small, and then at the end of the day, this Allen deviation of Allen variance will be proportional to this kind of expression, where t small is the total interval, t big is the time of one of these Ramsey sequence, and then this one is the uncertainty of estimation. So this uncertainty of estimation is the key. So basically, to understand the role of quantum noise, what we can do, we can just compare two cases. So in one case, this is kind of a conventional case of Ramsey spectroscopy, what you do, you interrogate atoms individually. In other words, so you prepare them, you know, basically with the lasers in some kind of coherent superposition state, and you just essentially have n copies of this of these atoms. And then what happens is after the free evolution, you know, each of these atoms gets some phase. And then if you imagine basically, you know, just measuring, you know, each of atoms individually in this case, what will happen that for each of the atoms, basically the uncertainty in frequency with which you can measure this frequency will be given by 1 over t, right? So this is basically just, you know, follows from the uncertainty relation. So and then if you have n copies, then just from the central limit theorem, what you will get, you know, you will get essentially the uncertainty which scale as 1 over square root of n. So let's now compare it with the a different case. So this is what's called standard quantum noise. So, but it turns out it's not the best uncertainty that you can achieve. So we can compare, to illustrate it, we can compare it with the atoms which are prepared in this so-called entangled, or, you know, sometimes called GHG or KET state, where basically, you know, it's a superposition of states where all atoms are either in a state 0 or in a state 1, and there is a well-defined phase between them. So what happens in this case, if we just let the superposition evolve, then what will happen is that the phase here will evolve n times faster as composed opposed to the individual atom case. And so then, you know, if you make a measurement on this superposition, so it's just one measurement, it's just one, you know, big quantum state, you can only measure it once instead of n times. But if you make the measurement, then what you see here, sorry, it should be delta n nu times t on the order of 1. And so basically, immediately, what you find is that in this case, the time uncertainty scales like 1 over n instead of 1 over square root of n. So this is the essence of the field, which is known as quantum metrology, where you would like to use this kind of entangled non-classical states to improve on the standard quantum limit. So historically, I should say that this was the first motivation for people to start looking at, you know, entanglement in atomic systems. That's how, you know, people like Dave Vineland started to get interested in, you know, entangling ions and creating non-classical states of ions, right? So this is this kind of enhancement of signal to noise, if you want, due to the entanglement. Now, so this idea is by now like 20 years old or so, and there has been, you know, a number of kind of proof of concept experiments done in different systems. So in the systems of ions, you know, in this, basically in ion clocks, experiments with a few ions have been carried out, you know, few meaning like 3 to 10. So this is, I think, one of the examples where this, you know, GHG or KET state of 2, maybe 3 or 5 ions were prepared. What you see basically is that, you know, the reason how you see that this was a KET state is because this oscillations, the oscillation period becomes shorter, the oscillation frequency increases, and it's precisely this expression of what I illustrated before. The phase actually starts to, you know, be, you know, you start requiring phase faster and faster. So of course, what you also see is that the amplitude of this oscillation goes down, and it's because this KET states are fragile with respect to decoherence, but, you know, this is a separate story. So it's, you know, makes this experiment very hard. So the control should be very, very good. So at the same time, several groups have done experiments in which they entangled a larger cloud of neutral atoms and, for example, used them in microwave clocks. So in this case, they don't use this kind of GHG type states. They use so-called spin squeeze states, but basically, you know, just technical details. So the result is that, you know, with this kind of entangled states, what you can do, you can basically improve the performance of the clock, at least at short averaging time. So this is the data from Vladen's group, I think from a couple of years ago, and so What's compared here is the unentangled, just conventional kind of, you know, Ramsey measurement. Then it's compared with the atoms which have been, you know, prepared in this entangled state. And this is a so-called standard quantum noise limit. So that's as good as you can do with unentangled atoms. And what you see is that with entangled atoms at short averaging time, you really gain. And then as the time progresses, eventually you come to the point where, you know, basically, you know, this gain, you know, disappears. And this is at the point where kind of decoherence takes over. So basically, once your clock, you average your clock for times which are much longer than the coherence time of the of your oscillator, of your atomic oscillator, then you cannot really gain.
I'm not sure if you could interpret it correctly. This is our variance that the coherence time has to be smaller than the shortest one of these.
So it's kind of qualitative.
Sometimes it's a different interpretation, but you know, relaxation is an important issue.
Yeah, it's a relaxation time. So basically, the coherence time, of course, of the oscillator of the source is much shorter, right? So it can correct. So basically, the bottom line, which what I would like to is that, you know, basically this, you know, the so long as the atoms are coherent, right? These squeeze states really help you. Right, so you can correct the noise from the oscillator, right? But you know, if eventually you come to the limit where you are limited by the coherence times of atoms, and that limit you cannot overcome.
Yeah, but for squeezed states, the requirement is not just coherence time; it is much more stringent, as you said yourself.
No, it actually turns out its requirement is a coherence time, and actually, if you guys are interested, I have a couple of slides to explain it, but I thought it might not be interesting for our, you know, high energy physics colleagues. So it's actually by now well established that even with GHG states, you can improve the clock up to the times associated with atomic coherence. I mean, this improvement might not be, you know, big, but you know, you can improve it all the way.
The scaling doesn't even change. The square root of
at the end here, the scaling doesn't. Here, the scaling changes.
And then it shouldn't be federal.
That's okay. So it's a good point. So of course here. So I mean, what I my answer to the Dimas question was for the maximally entangled state. So here. The states were prepared which were not maximally entangled, so as a result, so they had just small, you know, certain, you know, I don't know, maybe 10 dB of, you know, few dB of squeezing. So in this case, of course, scaling does not change, right? But so if you basically start with maximally entangled state, for example, like GHG states, so what happens?
This is scaling with time, but you're talking about scaling with number.
Okay, so you guys, you're also such a curious people. Let me just. So here is, you know, here is kind of basically the. This is not an experimental data, but this is kind of, you know, a simulation with the appropriately chosen feedback loop. Of the situation where you basically start, you know, you can prepare GHG state. And what happens then is that to begin with, you know, if you prepare GHG state in an appropriate manner, and basically about the appropriate manner means that you actually should not prepare one largest single big GHG state, but you should prepare several groups of GHG states, where basically different groups have phase which evolve at different rate. And the key idea is that basically you have to avoid phase slips. So GHG state helps you to pick up the phase very rapidly. If you just use one big GHG state, you very rapidly pick up 2 pi phase shift, so you cannot enjoy a long interrogation time. So basically the way how you get, you know, this improvement is that you divide your entire atomic ensemble into groups. And then you interrogate them to pick up different digits of the phase. So it's a kind of phase estimation algorithm. And, you know, as a result, then at short times, you can really enjoy this 1/T scaling. But of course, eventually you hit this limit, which is determined by atomic decoherence. And that limit you cannot overcome. And this, of course, this limit is square root of t. Right? I hope this makes it clear. Right?
So the key here, I guess, is the noise of the coherence that block last collate is worse than the coherence type of the arc.
Well, it could, this better be, otherwise it makes no sense to build a clock, right? So if you start...
Usually, you know, at the last layer to discipline the clock on the random time scale, so you don't set on the... That condition is the whole separate.
No, but you know, but realistically, right? So you would like to. But well, of course, now, of course, you know, it now what you, I guess, maybe you're referring to in practice, there might be the noise spectrum of the laser. You know, I mean, the things will depend on what's the noise spectrum of the laser. So here, just assume white noise. So for this example, it has to be satisfied, right? But of course, you know, in practice, there might be different noise spectrum with details, but that's kind of, that's a general picture, right? Is it clear? All right, okay. So with this kind of caveats, so we now come to this point here. So so basically at short times you know, having this squeezing is good. So the second ingredient which I would like to introduce now, which we will utilize, is this idea of quantum networks. So this idea, you know, has been now also kind of around for maybe 10 or 50 years. And so in most cases, you know, people who work on these networks have a motivation of doing long-distance quantum communication or long-distance quantum cryptography. And the idea is that, you know, if you basically just, you know, if you want to, for example, send quantum key, you know, essentially information encoded in the qubits, you can only do it so long as the signal is not absorbed in a channel. Because, you know, once you start having absorption, then basically, you know, for example, single photons will be lost. And you cannot, you know, if you start trying to amplify this kind of, you know, signal, you will not gain any kind of information. So basically, to circumvent that, the idea of quantum network or quantum repeater has been introduced. And the idea was essentially to use some kind of memory nodes for storage and processing. They're essentially kind of like small quantum computers. And then they're linked for transmission by optical photons. So basically, this quantum network is essentially, you know, a set of small quantum processors which are connected via these photonic channels. So this communication should be done via photons.
So the whole system is coherent then?
So the idea, well, you know, a certain time scale, right? So you basically, for example, you know, in one goal, what you do, you are trying to for example, you know, do quantum cryptography over, say, 1,000 kilometers, right? And what you do, you basically establish first entanglement on small links. And then what you do is entanglement is not perfect, so you have to purify this entanglement. You have to do quantum error correction, you know, and then over the entire time that it takes to basically, you know, do this operation, the whole system should be coherent. But there can be errors which can be corrected, right? So it's a kind of quantum error correction, if you want, a simple version. So this idea has been around already for some time, and you know, experimentally, there are a couple of proof of principle demonstrations by now, where actually people, for example, you know, entangled, you know, two or actually three nodes, and even performed some of this kind of rudimentary quantum error correction, entanglement purification. But of course, you know, we're nowhere near to be able to basically do this over, you know, 1,000 kilometers. So this is still, you know, a big challenge. And, you know, one of the challenges is, for example, you know, connected to your question. So basically, you know, for that to work, you have to store information for a very long time, right? So that's a requirement of like second long memory, right? So you have to store qubits while you sort of wait for all of this purification to work. So And basically, but you know, there is very active, it's a very active field now, and so people are working on basically, you know, improving this, improving efficiencies, fidelities, doing quantum gates, doing some kind of integration, scaling up. So it's actually this really kind of very active in this interdisciplinary field, and this can really be one of the first applications of small quantum processors. So I actually don't want to really go into details, but I thought I will just give one example of the work which we are doing to implement these quantum networks, because it's actually related to a couple of talks which have been, which we have heard today. So in this approach, what we are trying to do is basically interface single cold atoms with a solid state devices. And essentially what we learned over the last, you know, few years or so is how to start with the kind of devices illustrated here. So what is shown here, let me just explain. So this is a fiber. This is just a conventional optical fiber which has been thinned and broken at the end. At the end of this fiber, there is this kind of dielectric waveguide. So it's just basically a piece of dielectric with some kind of, you know, holes. So this is a so-called photonic crystal. And so what we can do in our experiments is we can bring individual atoms and position them basically kind of a quarter wavelength away from this photonic crystal. So these distances are in the range of 150 to 200 nanometers. The reason why we are doing it is because we want these atoms to basically interact with the localized photon modes so that we can very efficiently, for example, collect the light which is emitted by the atom and direct it into this fiber. So this is basically, if you want, is this atom-photon interface. The reason why this is interesting maybe for this community here is that while, you know, we have atoms at this close distance, of course we can measure forces between the atom and this dielectric. And we have certainly seen some forces due to this atom dielectric interaction, so they're actually sizable. But the real question is, you know, can one use this system, for example, to probe this kind of, you know, this gravity at short distances? And we actually thought about it. So to be honest, you know, like, I mean, I just, from what I've seen, you know, all of these electrostatic forces and patch potentials really overwhelm everything. But I mean, it sounds like there are a couple of groups which actually are trying to reach this kind of regime. So maybe it's something that is might be interesting to explore. But anyhow, so what we have done so far with this system, we really have used it as a kind of very efficient atom-photon interface. For example, this system provides a nonlinearity at a single photon level. So if you send light into this kind of system, then depending on send a light pulse, then depending on how many photons are in this light pulse, like 0, 1, or 2, the light which comes out picks up different phase shifts. For example, in optical interferometer, that way we can sort out single photons. We can direct single photons in one output port of the interferometer and photon pairs in another. So it's really kind of a nonlinearity at a single photon level. Or what we can do, you know, with one, just one photon, we can flip the phase of the atom. So that's this measurement. So basically, this is just a normal kind of Rabi curve. And then, you know, if we interrupt this Rabi curve and just hit it with one photon, then the phase of this, you know, atom superposition changes. So anyway, so just kind of, you know, to illustrate that we are really kind of advancing in implementation of this quantum networks, but actually this also might be tool for some kind of interesting short distance force measurements.
Misha, what is the optical Q of that
resonator? For this data, that was about 10,000. So up to now, we can fabricate resonators with Q up to a million. And the mode volume here is below a wavelength.
And the atom doesn't spoil that Q, does it?
The atom is precisely the effect that you, I mean, like, you know, in uncoupled atom doesn't spoil this Q. But, you know, when the atom is in a coupled state, it completely, it basically just not, doesn't allow photon to enter. You know, and that's precisely what, you know, it's a fate. Basically, it's a phase shift which it picks up, right? Depending whether atom goes in the cavity or not, that's the effect which we are looking for. So atom has a, one atom has a huge effect, right? Okay, so okay, so basically, in this, you know, work that, you know, the organizers asked me to talk about, we basically try to kind of bridge these two fields of quantum metrology and quantum networks. And the idea is the following. So suppose we have, you know, a set of quantum clocks, which you know, belong to several labs, maybe they belong to different nations, and these clocks are as good as one can, you know, imagine building using, you know, the laws of quantum mechanics. And so the question is, can we somehow optimize the use of all of these resources? And actually, the best possible thing that one could do, you know, if one kind of in a simple-minded way, is just try to prepare all of these atoms and all of these clocks in this kind of one big GHG state. So, you know, if one can do it, then, you know, collectively, you know, these, all of these clocks, you know, will really deliver the best, you know, timing signal possible. So in a sense that this will really utilize all resources optimally. So it actually turns out that, since in order to entangle these atoms, you need to use basically some quantum states. So this actually clock can be run in this kind of secure quantum protected mode that only the people basically who contribute to this network can benefit from the stable signal. And, you know, basically this, you know, kind of is an interesting thing because such a network would really create a strong incentive for different parties to collaborate. So this is kind of, you know, the one approach to solve all problems of the world. You know, so and so this basically as such is one could create this kind of ultimate world clock with very high stability and accuracy. Okay, there are a couple of questions. It's basically, that's the idea, right? So the question is, okay, so first off, you know, can this be done?
Sorry, yeah. Is there fundamentally any advantage of having the example of politics, having these separated clocks rather than building one super clock consisted of 10 clocks in one location?
No, that's a very good question. There are two answers for that. So first off, of course, the simplest way would be to put all atoms in one clock, but there might be some, you know, technical limitations for that. So that, for example, you cannot have much too high density of atoms, right? Or you can not have much too high interrogation volume, right? So in this case, you know, but in this case, you could still have basically several clocks, for example, at NIST, located at NIST, right? So, but, you know, then there is actually an important factor here is that basically, you know, if these are clocks which are operated by different parties, then what is important, you know, is that each of these parties, you know, if, for example, if this, you know, link is broken, will have its own reference. So basically, if, for example, you know, all countries, you know, in a simple way, agreed that they give all information to US, right? This would not, you know, some people would not like. I mean, some people maybe in US would like it, you know, but in the other countries they might not like it because basically then the party who's in possession of the super clock controls everything. So the idea here is that you don't give up kind of sovereignty, so that that if someone, you know, kind of breaks this communication channel, which is the easiest thing to do, you could resort to your own clock, but then, you know, still you could, you know, benefit from this entire. So that's, I think that's really the key reason why you might want to have it really truly distributed, except for maybe some precision measurement applications. So, but you know, that's the only reason, I would say. Okay, so, the question now is, you know, can this be done with some kind of realistic means, you know, unrealistic means, for example, that it would not involve moving the atoms from one location to another or doing any other kind of crazy stuff, you know, then, you know, what would be the actual benefit and then how can you use this kind of system? So I'll just briefly talk about that. So first of all, you need to somehow come up with the idea to prepare this big entangled states. And, you know, one idea to do that could involve something which is called teleportation. So essentially, the idea is the following. So suppose you prepare some entangled state locally in one node, let's call it a center node, and then at the same time prepare non-local entangled states of just single, you know, qubit pair between the center and certain node. So then what one could do is just by making a simple measurement here at the central node, you can basically transfer the entanglement between this type of system of qubits to this type, to basically instead of having this guy entangled, you immediately entangle this other guy. And so that way you can, you know, start kind of growing this entangled space. So this way you can basically start entangling, you know, these guys with one of the qubit here, and then, you know, by doing some kind of local operation here, you can eventually, you know, start creating states like this. So let me just maybe illustrate this one more time here. So basically, suppose that you have a kind of system of qubits, and so suppose you just prepare a superposition of one of them. So what you can do then, you can basically use the superposition either through the sequence of control node gates or by using things like Rydberg blockade. So it's basically technical stuff. What you could do, you can, you know, then prepare some kind of local entangled states. And then in addition, what you could do by just sending photons and interfacing photons with atoms, you can prepare these non-local pairs. So once you've done it, right, so you end up with this kind of local cat and this non-local entanglement. And then in the next step, what you do, you basically perform this kind of measurement in a certain, in a Bell basis, so-called Bell basis, and that's how this you create this kind of teleported states. And then what you can do, you can just basically proceed with this type of entanglement growth. Right? So that's a way how, in principle, you can create this global entangled states. So, I mean, this is in principle possible, in principle realistic. Nothing of this kind has been done, you know, but, you know, basically a lot of tools, I'd say most of tools to do it have been demonstrated, but not at the level that you can, you know, entangle zillion of atoms together.
If you have decoherence time for one system of tau, what would be the decoherence time for a network?
Yeah, it will be n tau. This would it,
one, yeah, n one,
tau.
No, tau over n.
Yeah, tau over n, yes, yes. well, it's gamma times n, yeah, tau over n, yes, that's right. But note that a lot of these kind of, for example, these operations, for example, you don't, so basically non-local operations, for example, you can do with atoms which are not even, or with states which are not even clock states, right? So only when you, and basically what you can do, you can wait with operating on a clock transitions only up until at the time when you start actually to run your clock. So there are, it's kind of, you know, it's challenging. But, you know, and while preparation, you can also use quantum error correction. So it's not completely, it's difficult, but it's not completely insane, you know, so. But okay, so once you've now prepared this entangled state, of course, you can initiate your clock cycle, and then what you need to do, you need to basically somehow read out the information. And kind of in our approach, what we envision is that basically each individual node will have its own local oscillator, its own laser, and will perform its own clock cycle. And then basically what, you know, what you need to do, you just need to measure qubits locally. So for example, in the case of this GHG state, what you could do, you could just measure the qubits in this kind of plus minus in this X basis. And so what will happen in this case is the following. So you start with this big entangled state. So it turns out that, you know, this measurement, depending on the phase, whether it's zero or pi, would give either even out all even outcomes or all odd outcomes. So specifically, basically, you know, if phase is, you know, zero, then, you know, you will always have so like the product of all of these outcomes will be even. Or if the phase is pi, then if you multiply all of these outcomes, it has to be an odd function. So that way, in this big state, we can basically figure whether, you know, the phase was acquired or not. So there's just one measurement, but, you know, it gives you a little bit of a feeling how this can be done. So, and then at the end, of course, what you'd like to do, you'd like to use this information somehow to steer your clock signal. And there are two ways how you can do it. So in one approach, you what you can do, you can basically just, you know, take each individual clock and without any kind of entanglement, just try to basically, you know, compare all of these clocks together. Comparison means that you need to basically, you know, send, you know, someone, for example, the central node, you need to send your local oscillators, and you also, and basically what the central node then can calculate a center of mass frequency, and then send this information back. And, you know, that way you can actually average over several clock signals. So it will be a classical average. Now, if instead you perform this procedure which I just described, and then you send these measurement bits, then what the center can do, it can very accurately estimate the center of mass, the error for the center of mass frequency, and basically then, you know, send this information back, and then that way, you know, all of these clocks can be synchronized with the precision which will depend basically on all of these qubits in the network. Okay, so maybe it was a little bit too much kind of technical details already, but so basically just, you know, to kind of summarize, so there might be two ways how this, you know, the parties in this network can cooperate. One could be classical cooperation where they just share local oscillator signals. Or, you know, if you involve this entanglement and this kind of collective measurement, this kind of quantum cooperation. And so basically if you do the classical cooperation, you basically improve with the square root of a number of clocks. If you do this quantum cooperation, you know, basically you get the best precision possible. It just everything improves as a total number of atoms. Now, when under which conditions can this really help? So this is kind of another of one of this Allen variances plot. So this is now kind of normalized to what is a sort of ultimate, you know, limit, which is basically given by the atomic decoherence. So eventually it will scale like one as a square root of tau. But now at this kind of relatively short averaging times, so what basically we find is that, you know, if our clocks start cooperating, even classically, we always, you know, improve. And if they cooperate in a quantum mechanical way, they get basically the best possible improvement. So this is this red curve. So now one could actually ask the question is, you know, so how would this be, you know, the signal can be? And of course, it really depends now on specific parameters. So for these are like the parameters, if you, for example, take, you know, a number of atoms per clock, something like 1,000, for example, is a now optical clocks operate with this number. So if we take, for example, 10 clocks, and if we take this, you know, the ratio between local oscillator and the atomic decoherence rate as a kind of 10 to the, I think it should be minus four. So then, you know, what you find is that, you know, you can really, you know, achieve some, you know, incredible, you know, stability. So, and, but, you know, of course this, you know, now one should be a little bit careful because a lot of other things can happen. But just as a summary of this part, so like there are a few key features which are interesting. So one of them is the related to the question that Dima asked. So, so this kind of network will really allows parties to profit from global stability without losing their sovereignty. So also, you know, if we kind of, if the result, if this final signal is not broadcast, you know, openly, then this network can cooperate in such a way that only those who contribute would benefit from that. But then maybe most importantly is that, of course, there is always difference between accuracy and stability. And the point which I think is very important is that if you really have some very stable reference, it might allow one to actually estimate the systematic differences between nodes with a very high precision. In other words, if one of the nodes has a clock which deviates, right, if you have a very stable kind of center of mass reference, you can find these deviations very rapidly with very high accuracy. And this is perhaps the most relevant thing for this workshop. So And basically, you know, one question is, you know, like, what would you do with this network? And I think one really, you know, potentially one can think about some kind of, you know, incredible, you know, non-local precision measurements. So, I mean, I think there are some kind of standard things. For example, you can certainly look at this clock-based, you know, geodesy relativity. So, kind of a little bit less trivial could be maybe looking at gravitational waves. I think at 10 to the minus 21, you can look at gravitational waves. So I think there's potentially also maybe these axion searches that, which I don't know very much about, but I guess there are a lot of people who are kind of in this audience who know about this. So, but perhaps the most intriguing things could be to think about using this kind of networks for either dark matter or even dark energy detection. I will maybe say a few words about it. But, you know, last but not least, we're actually thinking about also not just about clock networks, but also extending it to other types of sensor networks. And what this kind of entangled sensor networks allow you to do, you essentially, they allow you to take advantage of this kind of quantum algorithms. And basically, what this kind of quantum computer is very good about is it's very good about, you know, finding, you know, some kind of specific states. For example, if you look for some specific pattern of signals, you can sometimes find it in just basically one shot instead of really looking at all of these qubits one by one. And I think, you know, well, there are some interesting applications where this could really be useful. So maybe actually, for example, we are thinking of brain science applications, but, you know, perhaps also, you know, in the type of experiments that you guys are thinking. Okay, so if this part was not speculative enough, I would like to now don't report it. You know. So I would actually like to even talk about something which is really a lot more speculative in the sense that I really kind of don't know very much about. So, and this was a little bit inspired by yesterday's discussion, and also a little bit inspired by, you know, a couple of conversations we had with some of my colleagues. So. So basically, the question is, can you use this type of systems to probe fast variations of fundamental cost? And by fast, I really mean like, you know, frequencies kind of gigahertz and upward. So for example, as far as I understand from the discussion yesterday, this, if you ask a question about the variation in alpha, then the size of this variation will likely grow as you increase the frequency. Maybe it's totally wrong. I just learned it yesterday. I have no idea whether it's true or not, but, you know, that's what, you know, so you guys should comment maybe, you know, about this. So, I mean, basically for that reason, it might be interesting to try to look at some kind of, you know, atomic clock transitions at, you know, at high frequencies. But, you know, there is one other problem, which is maybe perhaps even more interesting. So this is this dark energy problem. So I think, you know, I hope this previous talk, you know, inspired you to think that, you know, essentially this is really an open question and any kind of experimental result here would have a huge impact. And so there is one kind of group of, you know, thinking or group of theories which tries to address this cosmological constant fine-tuning problem by thinking about basically some kind of dynamics of dark energy. As far as I understand, you know, this kind of, you know, some of these theories boil down to the following. So that basically you have some kind of like a time-dependent vacuum type phenomena, which should be, you know, which is basically a high frequency effect. So this, you know, apparently somehow helps to kind of resolve this problem maybe. You know, but the characteristic frequencies are here is something like 10 to the 12 hertz. So associated with these frequencies, there is also some kind of coherence length, which is maybe 10 to 100 microns, which, you know, accompany this type of phenomenon. So the question is whether we can think about this atomic clock or some kind of precision measurements experiments to probe this kind of effects. And, you know, I must now say that I really don't know very much about it, but, you know, these ideas were mostly developed with Chris, and we occasionally talk to Nima, who thought that this is not insane. So, but you know, don't take it for, you know, even if Nima says that, it might not be true. So, So first, you know, 2 points. So first off, we actually know how to measure AC quantities. And as a matter of fact, this is the idea which we came up with Dima in this, you know, paper, which actually started the field of kind of solid state spin-based magnetometry. But the idea is basically the following. So if you want to look for some high frequency signal, you kind of need to slow your clock down. Or what you need to do, you need to basically interrupt the Ramsey sequence with the so-called pi pulses. So what basically pi pulses do, they reverse the direction of precession of your spin. So in other words, if you basically had some kind of signal, let's say magnetic field, which was changing in time, then if you can apply your this kind of, you know, time reversal, if you want, pulses in sync with this signal, then you can really zoom in at the signal at this given frequency, right? And so that way you can essentially, and particularly if this kind of this, you know, so-called echo pulse timing is matching these AC frequencies, you would really be most sensitive. So it's essentially, this is a way how to do precision measurements of fast, rapidly oscillating quantities with essentially clock precision. So this kind of longest precession time will be limited here basically by either atomic coherence time or source coherence. If source is not coherent, then of course there will be also some kind of averaging. So, I think I should basically, you know, kind of stop, but, you know, I just should say that, you know, we successfully use this kind of techniques in a microwave domain. And we actually, you know, it's a very different type of measurement, but in this measurement, what we do, we're basically trying to, we're actually kind of detecting the signal from just MRI signal from very few nuclear spins. And in these measurements, what we do, we apply, you know, massive amount of these pulses, like, you know, hundreds of pulses. And that way we can really pick up the Larmor precession of individual nuclei, essentially. So the question which I would like to pose here, and that will be my basically last slide, is can we use this type of techniques to probe, you know, some rapidly varying, you know, properties of fundamental constants? For example, you know, what if you have, you know, some clock network, and basically this clock network can be interrogated by, you know, by trains of pulses, you know, spaced by appropriate distances. And, you know, basically then what you do, you try to compare the result, right? And the prediction, for example, could be that if this these clocks are very close to each other, these atoms are very close to each other, this noise should be identical. If they go far away, you know, this coherence length of the signal should result in a kind of washout of this effect. So I think this is kind of very intriguing idea. So it's a little bit related to something which have been discussed in the community. There is a so-called dark energy induced noise controversy in Josephson junction. But, you know, this is really much more controllable measurement. It makes use of the fact that atomic clocks are probably the best measurement devices in the world. There is only one little problem. And one little problem is that while this allows one to, in principle, to probe spatial and temporal kind of coherence of these variations, the real question is, you know, what would be kind of interesting bounds for the signal value? So suppose that one invests some time and does this measurement, you know, like, you know, usually one obtains zero, right? So which of the zeros, when is this zero interesting? And so that's really a challenge to all participants of this work, at least of you. All right, so that's all what I wanted to say.
Wanted to comment that the oscillating scalar field that we were talking about yesterday, it can, you know, serve as a dark matter, and also there will be a coherence time built into this.
Exactly.
Because the things are falling into the gravitational potential, so there is like a factor of roughly 10 to the 6 coherence time relative to the period of oscillation. So it's a possibility also for the decoherence at a longer yeah. scale due to the interaction.
No, but like things like this, I think things like this type of use approach, we can totally measure. The only question is, can one put the bounds? I mean, like, what I would be, well, maybe we can talk about this afterwards.
All right. So, I will have questions from there.
Okay. So, in fact, when you talk about these oscillating moments, right, oftentimes you actually brought up the worry about naturalness, et cetera, yesterday. Now, there's one kind of field where it's very natural for it to be very light, which would be like a dark photon. Is it just like a time-varying electric field that's moving on with the thing? And of course, you try to couple that directly to an atom, that would be a dipole, so you would basically have a sort of a dipole square kind of thing. And that'll be very small, so it would probably not be very useful. But I was wondering if you could do these clock measurements by applying an electric field in your atom. So you automatically polarize to start with, and that gives rise to a dipole moment, and that's something you could build later.
That's absolutely possible, yes. And moreover, like, at least for atoms which are not too far, I mean, of course, the question will be kind of in homogeneity of this field, but this, actually, these AC measurements, you know, would not be sensitive to that, right?
Exactly.
So it's, you know.
Two questions, actually. In this clock network, the local oscillator needs to be shared in order to gain something, right?
Yeah, so basically what we are thinking about is something like a laser, right, which
but
has, you know.
Then this argument with sovereignty is kind of, because the whole network relies on one laser.
No. So each of the, so the idea is that each node has its own laser.
So but each
clock
has
its
own,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And then afterwards you compare. So that's, you know, that really each at each party you have a clock, right?
And the second question is about these sensors. You need to be close with this spin echo measurement. This timing must. You need to somehow assume
be,
the frequency you measure.
It has to be like terahertz in this case. So
but then you need to be close with the frequency.
If you really have very narrow band signal, yes. I mean, you know, if you look for a broader band signal, it's, you know, you don't have to be very close.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I mean, there are different, you know, there are ways you can play with that. And actually, let's say in the microwave domain, we utilize a lot of this. We can now see narrowband signals, broadband signals. I mean, the best is, of course, if it's a narrowband signal and then you're close. And then what you do, you then scan, right? So this, for example, these plots, which I've, you know, the actual data that I've shown that I did not explain, is basically a signal, an MR signal from, you know, basically, you know, few protons from sub-nanometer proton volume. Where what we did, we basically scanned this timing of the echo, and then what you see when the echo matches the Almore precession, you see the signal. So that's actually, it's a feature in this case.
I'm wondering, how can relativity be incorporated into your quantum network of clocks? Isn't it that the differences in relativistic shifts would add to the...
Yeah, that's totally, absolute. Well, it would not, okay, so in our understanding, it does not add to decoherence, but it adds to systematic shifts between the different clocks. And of course, the systematic shifts is something which, with this network, one could measure very precisely. So it kind of becomes a feature. So that's this application to this, you know, geodesy, right? But of course, you know, if there is additional, if there is some kind of true decoherence due to the gravitation, I think this would be very interesting.
I agree, that would be an interesting experiment in quantum gravity, but I'm just wondering if the network really allows a higher stability, or if extra information is needed to take these local shifts into account, because you basically understand that you want to use the signals from many atoms to improve the stability of the oscillator. If contribute different frequencies.
Yeah, but you know, basically what you need to do, you just, you know, in this case, I mean, you obviously need to track these satellites, and what you need to do, you need to send the information about their location, right? And that's, I mean, like, you know, or you can check the information about their location against this.
That's what's done today in the classical.
That's right, that's right. No, no. Well, no, but look.
We have more questions. So.
So there is experiment with the fermilab where the look, I guess it's called holography thing, where you look at the coherence between two interferometers in the similar to LIGO. And you sort of look at that in comparison with this clock, the coherence.
So this here, they involve, you know, we use matter waves, matter states, right? So this, I think all of these other experiments, we basically just, you know, look at light signals. So in that sense that,
But the basic motivation is the same.
Well, maybe potentially one application of this could be of this type. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I have actually a follow up on question on this question. So, what's the effect of space? You showed in your system that you have identical qubits that are entangled, and phi of the phase. So, what's the phase if there is a difference between the?
So basically, each. So what happens in this in approach, which I described, at each location, what is being probed is a local, is a phase difference between the local oscillator and the local cloud, right? And so, and then what you do, you combine them together. So you can either combine them all together, but in practice, what you do, you will, at times, you will test. So what you can also do, you can basically, you know, what you can do, you can, for example, compare. So you can either run it in a mode where you take everything together, or you can, for example, compare one of these clocks with the rest of a network, right? And that's where you would really, try to measure corrections, for example, due to this local gravity and so on. And or, for example, you can measure if something funny is going on with this clock, right? And basically what you need to do, I mean, so we kind of thought a little bit about it. So you need to, you know, run a kind of a protocol where you occasionally test different, you know, clocks to just, you know, verify that they supply the good signal, right? And that, for example, that way you can either try to measure some systematic effects, or if one clock intentionally tends to spoil a network, you can also figure it out and disconnect.
Well, last question.
Okay, you mentioned calculation in your talk, so I'm wondering if your network and Andrei's network is the same or different network.
Well, that's so you're asking, can this be used to do this kind of measurements? So I guess so, but I have not really. I mean, at first glance, it looks so, but okay. I mean, that's maybe something to really think about. Yeah.
So you have not talked about pattern recognition. Actually, that might be.
That's right. So you can prepare some. Yes. Yeah. So as I said, so like that's one thing which quantum computer is known to be very good at. It basically, if you know the pattern you're looking at, some kind of special correlation pattern. By preparing a right target state, you can just, you know, basically measure it very efficiently. So, I mean, up to now, this has not found any applications, but maybe here it could be, you know. So if you know wavelength, I mean, if you know the spatial scales, if you know kind of that the timing, you know, there should be a specific timing, maybe one could really use it in a very clever way.
All right, let's thank Michel.